Hey, it's the Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Stephen Brunt off today. He'll be back tomorrow. I am Ben Ennis. Let's bring in one of the absolute best, Amy Trask, CBS NFL analyst and former Raiders CEO. And Amy, thanks for doing this. I do want to start with something perhaps uncomfortable. Are you okay with that?
Well, I guess that depends. First of all, I'm not quite, you know, sure I gave any okay to Steve not being on today, but okay, let's take it from there.
All right. It's an anniversary, as you well know, today. A 20-year anniversary.
Here we go.
The 20-year anniversary of the Tuck Rule game, which at that point we should have realized that you know what, Tom Brady and Bill Belichick and that entire organization, they were just going to get all the breaks for 20 years. But in the fourth quarter of that divisional playoff game, Brady fumbles in the snow in New England. It's recovered by your Raiders, and then subsequently review changes the call. They kick the field goal, they tie the game, and then they win the game in overtime, and they win the Super Bowl, and they win a bunch more after that. What do you remember from that game?
New phone, who dis? I'm sorry, who are you trying to talk to? Who are you looking for? I think you have the wrong number. And by the way, thanks for the detailed recap, because of course, you know, as you're giving that recap, I'm thinking I really should just pretend we lost the connection and hang up and pretend I just, sorry guys, the connection went down. I don't know what happened to the phone lines. Well, you know, one thing people don't focus on as much as I think they should is that play occurred just inside the 2-minute warning. Yeah. And the significance of that is New England was out of timeouts. Had that play occurred, I don't know whether it was like, I don't want to do the math wrong on air, but maybe 7 seconds or so earlier, but certainly a very few seconds earlier, game over. Because outside of the 2-minute warning, of course, in order to overturn the play, New England would have had to challenge it. Because New England was out of timeouts, they couldn't have done so. So, you know, there's all sorts of issues going on. But the fact that a play occurred when it did and not 5-10 seconds earlier is the deciding factor in the game in many regards, because it was up to the league to implement a challenge because it was inside of 2 minutes. So yeah. What do I remember? You know, I remember seeing the play, seeing our players just go crazy on the sidelines. And by the way, he didn't simply fumble. Charles Woodson whacked that ball out of his hands. In the press box, where at that point we're in Foxborough, so there aren't fancy suites, so the staff of the visiting team is seated in a section of the press box, and no cheering is allowed in the press box. So I remember sitting with my colleagues. We see the play. We're all grabbing each other and squeezing each other's hands and grabbing each other's shoulders because we're not allowed to cheer. So we're doing a silent, you know, expressing our enthusiasm silently. And then I realized the play was going to be reviewed. And I turned and looked at then director of officiating, Art McNally. And I said, you better call 911. Because if you overturn this bleeping play, I'm going to have a bleeping stroke. And I didn't say bleeping, but I won't say what I said on air because I don't want to get you guys in trouble. And, you know, I'll end with sort of the funny story, if you will, that years later when Mike Silver did a profile on me for Sports Illustrated, someone shared that story with him. Only they said that Amy Trask turned and said, you better call 911, because if you overturn this bleeping play, I'm going to have a bleeping heart attack. And as I'm reading this, I look at my husband and I said, I didn't say that. I did not say that. This is just wrong. I'm calling Sports Illustrated right now and demanding a retraction. And my husband is just letting me go and letting me go and letting me go. And then he says, you know, before you call SI and demand to speak to their lawyers, let me tell you what you really said. What you really said was bleeping stroke, not bleeping heart attack. And I looked at him and I said, oh, okay, I guess I'll let it go.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You're a real pro to be able to to power through and still bring up those obviously very painful memories. If it's any consolation, obviously, like, it was, according to the letter of the law, it was the right call to overturn it. It was a horrible, horribly stupid rule, and they changed it immediately after that. But I think everybody understands that the spirit of the rule was not good.
Actually, I will actually take issue with that.
Oh, okay.
And look, this is all in good spirit, as good sports. And whenever I raise these issues, all these people rush in and say, but, what about, you know, and they start pointing out other plays. Guys, this is sports. And if we can't engage in this good-natured, good spirit rivalry, what are we doing? So I do believe it was a fumble. I do not believe the rule was correctly interpreted. When you look at photographs and you see the way Brady had reclasped the ball with both hands, I understand the rule. I don't think it was correctly interpreted or implied. But for everyone who's going to call in and annoy you and say, why'd you let that crazy woman on the radio? You know, guys, it's sports. If, you know, all the time in life, we're told you got to let it go, you got to move on. That's the fun of sports. We don't have to let it go. We don't have to move on. So there you go.
No, yeah. Listen, there's a lot of our listening audience that won't let go of the Blue Jays playoff loss in Game 6 to the Kansas City Royals in 2015. So yes, no, we're not in the business of letting things go either, Amy. Yeah, that's part of being a sports fan. Let's stay with the Raiders for a second, because obviously, the offseason, so much conversation is going to be about the coaching carousel, and perhaps there is not one happening in Las Vegas. Rich Bisaccia was an interim head coach, and now the players are coming out and advocating pretty hard for him to return to the Raiders. Does that count for anything when you're making those decisions? Does the players' opinion and them being so vociferous in their advocating for Rich, does that impact things?
I don't know if in this instance it will impact things. I don't know if Raider ownership will take that into account. I do believe that in this instance it should impact things. Not always. I mean, look, there are instances in which players will speak loudly in favor of a certain coach, but the organization knows it's just the wrong decision. In this instance, I think it should speak loudly. I mean, when you look at what the Raider organization, what happened this year, you have a coach who's just horrendous, horrific emails revealed who he was, and he was then out of his job. Some people will say he was terminated. Some say he was resigned. It doesn't matter. He was out as he should have been. Then a tragic, tragic accident in which a young woman lost her life, followed by another first-round pick seen on video dancing with a gun, and he's let go. And then you've got another DUI. And through this all, Rich Bisaccia found a way to right the ship, to stabilize things. The team won its last four games, went to the playoffs, obviously exited earlier than was hoped and then was the dream. But I think what he was able to accomplish, given all that went on this year, is very, very important. And the fact that the offensive leader, Derek Carr, and the defensive leader, Matt Crosby, have spoken out so strongly, I think should matter.
What is the process for these teams now? Because there's so many out there looking for head coaches, and you know what, the Raiders will probably do their due diligence either way, and they're going to interview candidates because Bisaccia, I guess, had the interim tag. They can't just hand it to him. What is the process now for these organizations? Because there's a number of very appealing candidates, and I'm sure some of these teams want to, you know, be quick acting so that they can jump the queue and make a decision quickly. What is the process at this point in the offseason?
A very, very different process for each team. 32 teams, obviously, not all are looking for coaches. I believe the number is 8 right now that are seeking head coaches. We don't know if there may be a change in Arizona. It's rumored that there may be. Who knows? Dallas has suggested, or at least Stephen Jones has suggested, there probably won't be a change. But as of now, there's 8 teams looking, and each of them have different processes. As to your point about being first in line to hire the head coach, it goes beyond that, because assume that you get the head coach you want, whether you hire first, third, fifth, or eighth, that coach has to assemble a staff. And if you're the last team to hire your head coach, then your head coach is going to be out there looking to assemble a staff after the other 7 teams have started doing that already. So there is a value in moving somewhat quickly, although you want to be right more than you want to be first.
You mentioned Cliff Kingsbury in Arizona. I was shocked to see the amount of conversation around his job security, considering this was year three. They've gotten better in every season he's been the head coach, and seemingly Kyler Murray is taking steps, and this was their first kick of the can in the postseason. Were you surprised to see that, you know, Cliff Kingsbury might be on the hot seat?
Not necessarily. Look, nothing, well, I shouldn't say nothing surprises me, because frankly, lots of things surprise me when it comes to things that probably shouldn't surprise me. Was that actually a sentence? This didn't surprise
we'll
me
count
because
it.
He's got a history and a track record, not simply in the National Football League, but going back to his years in college, of a team fading at the end of the season. In other words, what happened with Arizona fading over the last four or five games of the year, including and then in the playoffs, that's not aberrational for Cliff. That's happened to him before in Arizona. That happened to him when he was a college coach. So, you know, that's something that the Bidwells are going to have to factor into their analysis when making a decision about him.
How important is the relationship between a head coach and an owner? And I'm thinking specifically about Jerry Jones and Mike McCarthy, because, I mean, there could be a coaching change there, although Mike McCarthy today, I think, said that he felt pretty good about his job security. How important is it, especially when you have an owner as outspoken and as strong-willed as Jerry Jones is in Dallas? Do you want, like, in a perfect world, would you like a head coach that is not necessarily a yes man, someone that pushes back, or do you need someone that won't make waves with the owner in that instance?
Well, again, I think it depends on the business owner about who you're speaking. There are some owners who welcome pushback. I think pushback is healthy for an organization. And when I say pushback, I think a healthy business environment is one in which people are not only welcome but encouraged to disagree, because expressing disagreement and sorting through that is ultimately going to lead to better answers. But you're absolutely right. There are some business owners, and this isn't unique to football, that don't want people that disagree with them. So each owner is different in that regard.
Before we let you go, I do want to look ahead to the weekend a little bit, and I think people are looking at that Bills-Chief game as the de facto AFC championship game. Are we a little too quick to do that, considering the Titans beat both of those teams and they're getting Derrick Henry back?
I think your points are both well taken. We're all looking at that Bills-Chiefs game, and you know the word that I come up with for that game, it's a very technical football word. That is going to be a delicious game. I mean, I am excited about that game, but your point is so well taken as to Tennessee. They've gotten lost in the shuffle a lot this year. And by the way, a lot of coaches like that. You know, go ahead, overlook us. Don't make us the center of attention. Just keep on looking past us. We'll do our jobs. Tennessee is a very good team. As you noted, Derrick Henry's coming back. They're getting back some other players. They've had a chance to rest, and we don't know whether that rest is going to lead to the good part of rest or whether it will lead to rust, but I don't think anyone should look past Tennessee. That said, I can't wait for the Buffalo-Kansas City game.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be a beauty. Amy, thanks so much for doing this today. Thanks so much for, you know what, peeling off the scab and reliving that game from 20 years ago.
And for not hanging up on you and yes. Saying, new phone, who dis?
Yeah. You did say that, but in jest. thanks,
right.
Amy.
In jest.
See ya. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
There's Amy Trask, CBS NFL analyst, former Raiders CEO. Yes, 20 years ago today, Tom Brady took advantage of one of the worst rules in the history of football. It's like written right in there. Like, why would this be a good idea? When an offensive player is holding the ball to pass it forward, any intentional forward movement of his arms starts a forward pass, even if the player loses possession of the ball as he is attempting to tuck it back toward his body. Obviously, that rule was changed, but why that had to exist in the first place is an absolute mystery. Because at that point, you would think the quarterback understands that this is not a forward pass anymore. This is a fumble. And yes, the rule was changed shortly thereafter, but too little too late, and the sliding doors moment occurred, and Tom Brady was at that point touched by God. And then, you know, six Super Bowls later, he is where he is right now. The Toronto Blue Jays are where they are right now, which is in a good spot. They were one game out of the playoffs a season ago. They're on the ascension. They just signed Kevin Gausman. They just signed 18, 16-year-olds in the international market. It would be cool if they get to play a season this year. I mean, eventually that's going to happen. Hopefully it's a 162-game season, and hopefully it has something close to a full spring training, although I'm not holding my breath. Let's talk to Shai Davidi of Sportsnet. How's it going, Shai?
I'm all right, Ben. How are you?
I'm okay, I guess. Like a little bit nervous. Like at this, like I think I asked Stephen Brunt what the date was where I'm allowed to get nervous, and I think he said January 15th. So we're well beyond that, and we haven't seen a rebuttal from the MLBPA to the league's initial proposal here in CBA negotiations. Like, where are you on your nervousness level?
Well, I mean, I'm not super nervous because they're going to figure it out at some point, right? And if they want to blow themselves up in the process and hurt themselves, and, you know, maybe they need to do that. You know, they haven't done this in 20 plus years, and, you know, maybe they need a conflict to come back to their senses. But, you know, I still think that there's not much point in being nervous or getting worked up until, you know, even the first week of February, because look, if spring training gets shortened by 2 weeks, I don't think anybody's going to be too concerned about it. But once you start getting into that range, at that point, you're really eating into what, you know, the minimum spring training that you need is going to look like. And at that point, you're starting to get into the threat of games. So there's still a lot of runway here. You know, I would guess that both sides have a rough idea of where they want to end up. And, you know, right now it seems like neither one wants to be the side that blinks first. And I think that's part of what we've seen to this point.
What if you, like, host a radio show and you were hoping to maybe go down to spring training and host that radio show down from Dunedin for, like, a week, and, you know, a full month of spring training might allow that to happen a little bit easier? Would having only a two-week spring training be upsetting to you?
Well, you know, I mean, I understand that's a very substantial portion of the Major League Baseball fan base. You know, definitely a wide swath that impacts. I think that a lot of people really love spring training, and for them, you know, that's a big part of the baseball experience. And you know, I think all of us, you know, there's a certain romance to it, especially if you live in a northern clime and, you know, have happened to, you know, that recently experienced a snowmageddon like most of us here have in the past week. You're like, yeah, spring training is a real respite from it. But I don't know. I just think that really what it is, it's, you know, a month and a half for pitchers to get ready, and hitters need 3 weeks. So, you know, if you can get 3.5 weeks in, you know, most guys are going to be fine for the season, and you get the baseball that you want. So, you know, that's why I think that there's not a lot of point in getting worked up. But I think what would probably make a lot of bring people some relief is if there was a little bit of movement toward the other side, which we haven't seen yet. But knowing how baseball works and how they love deadlines before they move, and I can also understand why.
Yeah. Okay. I feel a little bit better about that. The deadline is a long ways away. To sign Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. You have a great big read out on sportsnet.ca right now called Risk and Reward. And the way it's actually positioned, it looks like those are their nicknames. It looks like Bo Bichette's nickname is Risk and Vlad Jr.'s nickname is Reward. That is not the case. That's the title of the story. And you detail some, you know, great information and great comparables as to what Bo Bichette and Vlad Jr. could be looking at if indeed the Blue Jays think about extending them before they reach free agency. Is there any way these guys get different contracts? I mean, they're very different players. I understand that very much. And you know what? Their numbers are different, but they're like value wise, they're pretty close. Do you see any way that one gets a deal before the other, and that they're significantly different?
You know, it's actually a great question. I didn't get into this element within the piece, right? But you know, how do you separate salaries between the two of them, right? If you're the Blue Jays, like, you can certainly make some analytical arguments based on the fact that Bo's a shortstop and Vlad's a first baseman and things of that nature. But I think when you look at sort of importance to the franchise and, you know, how so much is being built around them, you know, I mean, the Blue Jays are in a position where they've got two legitimate cornerstone players at the same points of their career at a very young age. I mean, I think probably for the first time since, you know, Delgado and Sean Green, and, you know, this is rare what they have right now. And, you know, like, can you pay one more than the other? And does that impact some of the relationship? You know, I think it would certainly be different if one signs well before the other. But, you know, if you're successful with only one and not the other, you know, that can be a little bit awkward too. So there's certainly a lot of different elements at play from a psychological and human nature standpoint in this. But I think from a value standpoint, I mean, if you're the Blue Jays, you're trying to pick between one or the other. I mean, could you? It's almost like, you know, asking someone to pick between their arms. You know, you really need them both.
No, it's a great point. And yeah, people might be listening and banging their head against the table saying, no, one guy just finished second in MVP voting. Yeah, that's true. And he does play first base. He plays pretty good defense at first base. Bo Bichette led the American League in hits, and he became at least an average defender at the most premium position there is in all of baseball. I think giving them mirror image contracts is not out of the realm of possibility. Speaking of contracts, things that we have that we can base some decision making on, we do have the Fernando Tatis Jr. 14-year, $340 million deal, but it's hard to imagine either of these guys signing before Juan Soto, who reaches free agency a year earlier. Shy, like, is that the one that we need to see first before we can really start, you know, crunching the numbers for these two?
Well, I mean, maybe, you know, I don't think that, you know, if I'm in one of those two camps, if I'm in the Bo camp or the Vlad camp, I'm not necessarily waiting for that, because, you know, I don't know if Juan Soto maybe creates a little bit of pressure on the top of the ceiling there, and maybe drags you up. But I think Fernando Tatis right now is a pretty solid comparable starting point. Maybe you're up a little bit, maybe you're down a little bit, whatever it may be, for both those guys, for a number of different reasons. And, you know, without sort of doing a bunch of math on air on the radio, you know, if you look at sort of where Bo and Vladdy's earnings are headed in their, you know, 3 to 6 service time years before they get to free agency, and where the market has been for players of their like in free agency, you know, you pretty quickly end up in and around that Tatis number, and, you know, and perhaps even beyond if they continue to climb. So I think for different reasons, it's a good starting point. And yes, Soto may change the market, but I think Soto for them becomes maybe a bit more of a comparable the longer they wait. Right. So, you know, right now in terms of service time, they're on the same track as Tatis. Soto, as you mentioned, is a year ahead of them. But as they start tracking closer to free agency, then perhaps Soto becomes a little bit more relevant.
Do you have any sense that even preliminary conversations have taken place between the Blue Jays and their representatives?
I mean, I don't know this definitively, but I think it's pretty reasonable to assume there have been, you know, at least some general conversations along the lines of, you know, is this something that you'd be interested in? And, you know, like what type of rough things would you be thinking about? What potentially could you be looking for? But I don't know that they've gone, I don't know for a fact those have happened. I just think it'd be a pretty safe assumption to believe that they have, and whether they've gotten anywhere, I couldn't tell you.
How risky would it be, really, to sign either both guys to 10-year deals? I guess injury would be a major concern. Obviously, it's concerned with any professional athlete, and both guys have had various injuries. I think performance-wise, I don't know, even if you get the low end of the spectrum with Vlad Jr., who has been a disappointment, his OPS was like almost 800 in his first couple of kicks of the can in the Major Leagues of Baseball, but both guys have performed at just about every single level. Like, how risky would, I mean, it would be a franchise alterer for sure to sign them to a decade long or decade plus long contract extension, but how risky would it be? And can you say one guy's a riskier proposition for a deal like that than the other?
I mean, In terms of risk, I think obviously the longer that you make a commitment for, you know, the likely you are to experience some ups and downs and some years where there are some injuries or some underperformance and things of that nature. And obviously, if you're buying years deeper into a player's 30s, then you're obviously going to be getting declined. So that's the risk there, right? You're guaranteeing money, and you don't know how a player's career is going to fully evolve. I think the reward comes in is that if the player continues to be on the same trajectory, that you've secured them for an extended period of time, you know, there's going to be a built-in discount, right? Because that's the trade-off. You guarantee money, but you get a bit of a discount. Mm-hmm. And you sort of lock that in. But if you look at it, you know, both those guys, I mean, they both profile really well. They both should continue to go online. But, you know, Bo plays the game really hard. And, yeah. You know, if he, you know, turns a knee, twists a knee, and maybe he's not the same player again, then, you know, that's a little bit of a risk. You know, with Vladdy, you know, we've seen if, you know, the physical conditioning isn't quite there, we saw in 2020 what a difference it makes and how different the swing looks, you know, between the 2020 version of himself and the 21 version. So, you know, those are some of the risks that you carry. But ultimately, if you have conviction in the player, you know, you believe in the player, and you can stomach some risk in pursuit of some discount over the long term, then, you know, that's part of the business. That's what's part of the deal.
Before we let you go, yeah, I mean, we know that Major League Baseball franchises can't have any contact with any of the players on their 40-man roster this offseason, which is not great if you are a franchise that is looking to make sure that one of your players has a good offseason conditioning program that Vlad did obviously last year, and it led into finishing second in the American League MVP race. Do you have any sense that the organization is a little bit nervous about the fact that they cannot keep tabs on him this offseason, or do they trust enough in his turnaround, in his transformation, and his dedication last offseason to feel confident that he's going to do it again this offseason?
Yeah, I think that you can trust enough in Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to be taking care of that. And, you know, he took ownership of what happened in 2020. You know, he immediately apologized to his teammates. You know, I believe he was the only Blue Jays player to appear in all 60 games in 2020 plus the playoffs. So, you know, even though he, you know, he didn't arrive at summer camp as his best self, you know, he took responsibility for that, made the decision to be accountable to his teammates and to himself. And, you know, he obviously saw the results. He thinks, rightly so, that last year was, you know, a starting point as opposed to a ceiling. And he's determined to, you know, have the type of career that his abilities allow him to. So, you know, I if I'm the Blue Jays, I'm not worried about that. You know, I think they've seen and heard all enough from Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and I think he's seen the difference himself in terms of the results of what that all means to him.
I would like to see him play baseball very soon. Hopefully, fingers crossed, that will happen. The story is Risk and Reward. You can check out the big read on sportsnet.ca, written by Shai Davidi. Thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah, no problem. I thought you'd enjoy CBA talk, like you wanted to drag out. So much fun.
No, that was more than enough. Yeah, we can talk about it again when it's over, okay?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right, see you, Shai.
Take care, pal. See ya.
See ya. There's Shai Davidi, sportsnet.ca. When we come back, Leafs at MSG tonight to play the Rangers. Jack Campbell, he's going to be in net. Jack Campbell, he's an all-star. Jack Campbell, he's a pending free agent. Let's talk about him with Kevin Woodley of NHL.com and In Goal Magazine next as the Fan Drive Time continues. I'm Ben Ennis. No Stephen Brunt today. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Stephen Brunt with the day off today. He'll be back tomorrow, so Ben Ennis flying solo. The Toronto Maple Leafs at MSG to play the Rangers tonight on Sportsnet. Jack Campbell will be in net, and he is no longer the National Hockey League leader in save percentage. He's second now at 931. So coming back down to earth. And the goaltending position is a tough one for the layperson to evaluate. Even if you've watched hockey your entire life, it is hard to evaluate that position. So let's bring in someone whose job it is to do that. And he does it better than anybody. It is Kevin Woodley of NHL.com and In Goal Magazine. How's it going, Kevin?
It's going good. I'm a little worried about living up to that that billing and the introduction. The reality of evaluating it is, like, you can look at it, and I may be able to look at it with a different lens than most people and maybe see some of the details a little bit differently. And I think more than anything in, over the past 15 years of sort of studying it is trying to understand what the goalie's trying to do when you evaluate whether they succeed or not. But I got to be honest with you, in terms of like looking around the league and evaluating everyone and sort of trying to compare them, the hardest part is it's often apples to oranges because of environment. And you're going to hear me reference this a lot today, is I lean heavily on a company like Clearsight Analytics, the analytics company sort of developed by Steven Valiquette, a former goaltender, to really weigh shot quality and compare those environments so that we can, you know, we can kind of compare the apples to the oranges, because there's one thing I've learned in talking to goalies over the last 15-plus years, it's goaltending never exists in a vacuum. It is always a product of what you're seeing in front of you.
Okay, so let's start right there, because I did a little bit of a dive into the numbers that I have available to me, which is like at Natural Stat Trick, which they're good, and, you know, anybody can check them out at naturalstattrick.com, but Leafs are kind of, they're in the middle of the pack as far as shots against per 60. Jack Campbell's high danger save percentage is kind of middle of the pack too, not nearly as high as his overall save percentage. So can you extract Jack Campbell? Can you separate his performance from the team's performance?
Yeah, and I don't, you know, it's funny because I didn't look at it that granular a level in terms of where he is in each type of shot. But what I can do is take a look. I mean, I can do that. I just hadn't going into this. Just bigger picture. Where does his performance overall to date relative to the quality of shots? So, you know, adding in the high danger or high percentage shots, mid percentage shots, low percentage shots, how he's performing relatively on all of those, totaling them and just sort of giving you, you know, that context. How is Jack Campbell relative to his defensive environment? And he's been really good. And the thing about it is, I wouldn't necessarily have said that last year. As a matter of fact, I took a little heat for pointing some of this out at the end of last season. Like, what did he finish last season? And I apologize. Well, you probably know better than me. Top of your head, save percentage last year at the end of the year was still in the 930s, right?
Maybe a little bit lower than that, but, yeah, it was very good.
Amongst the league leaders, kind of like the conversation, like I heard you saying coming in, he's not in the league lead, but he's up there. There's a difference massively last year to this year in terms of how much of that is team and how much of that is Jack. Last year, as good as his numbers were, he graded out just slightly above expected. That was a great defensive team. Now, it's not like you should punish him for playing behind it. Not every goalie can handle it, right? Like, you're not as busy. Some goalies thrive in a busy environment. And sometimes, you know, a lot of gaps between shots and when you're not busy and watching your team, you know, sort of rack up the shot totals at the other end, like, that's not easy mentally on a goalie. And so it wasn't taking anything away from his performance. Not everyone succeeds in that type of environment, but the truth is, defensively, they were so good that his performance relative to it graded out in the 30s, you know, league-wide. He was just above expected. This year, it grades out top 10, top 5, depending on how you look at it. Like, up until the last couple of weeks, it's dipped here a little bit, but his adjusted save percentage right now is, you know, plus 1.9%, which is top 10 in the league. Last year, it was plus 0.1%, which was 25th. Goals saved above expected. It was as high as 17, you know, on January 5th, and that was fourth in the league. It's dropped to 13.8 right now. But again, ninth, top 10. Last year, he was 32nd in goals saved above expected. So a lot of numbers to basically say that, you know, Jack Campbell probably got a little more credit for his numbers that were more about the environment last year, and yet this year he deserves full credit for how he's played behind this team. And I think a lot of that was early when I look at sort of that defensive environment. It was especially rough for the first month of the season, and it's graded out better and better as the year has gone on. And I liked what he showed in the beginning of the year, that, you know, when you need him to be great. When you need him to go outside the box, when you need him to make really tough saves, he still has that ability. It's not, you know, it's not like you're never going to face those, right? So it's important to show that you got to be able to manage a system that is, you know, largely, hey, it's goalie friendly, but not every goalie will thrive behind it. But sometimes, you know, things aren't going to be perfect and things are going to break down. And I thought for the first month of the season, especially, he should still showed he could be that guy that can bail you out when you're giving up, you know, 5 alarm chances on a more regular basis.
Yeah, and for reference, he was a .921 save percentage guy during the regular season last year, which was 22 games. He's already played 28. He started 27 this season with the .931 save percentage. So that's all well and good, and he's getting better, which is good. But he's 30, Kevin. So what does that mean? Like, I guess it's not necessarily that unusual for goalies to peak at 30, but usually you've been a starter for a while. It seems like a late age peak. What do you make of the fact that he's 30 years old and he is going to demand a pretty significant contract at the end of the season?
Well, there's kind of two parts to that, right? Like, the one part is, you're right, goaltenders, you know, sometimes we say things like they're late bloomers, and when we say, you know, like a lot of people like say, oh, goalies take longer. Not all of them do, but yeah, sometimes it tends to be. And quite often for different reasons, right? Like, you know, we see the Jordan Binningtons of the world. There's guys this year that are all of a sudden after 6-7 years in the minors, you know, having in smaller samples breakout campaigns. And there are so many different reasons that can go into why it clicks later on for some guys. Sometimes it'll be a new team with a new goalie coach and a new message that changes. I think Jack sort of struggles with mental health and identity early in his career, been well established there in Toronto. I know the story was told last year, just, you know, how much he sort of valued himself based on his performances as a goaltender and how tough that was as a high pick, you know, especially through the Dallas years, and how he kind of sort of reestablished himself in Los Angeles by maybe letting go of that a little bit. But I think one of the things that you have to keep an eye on when he got to Toronto too is, especially when I look at his, you know, break down his numbers specific to chance types, like all the different types of chances, clear-sighted shots, slot area, screens, broken plays, slot line, rebounds, deflections, like every area he's gotten better since he arrived there, especially slot line plays, rebounds, areas where I think in Los Angeles, even though he took a huge step there, there was still a lot of movement in his game. He was still a goalie that played with a lot of flow, a lot of rhythm. Anytime you play with flow, and we think of a goaltender who comes out on a rush and retreats with it, a little more movement, a little more timing, a little more rhythm reliant. Like, that to me was Jack Campbell. And he still got a little bit of that in his game. But I think he's taken, like, since he got to Toronto with goalie coach Steve Breer, I think he's less reliant on those things. Like, I think his game has, I don't want to say cleaned up isn't the right word, but it's just tighter tactically and technically, and it's a little less reliant on some of those more innate skills. And so as much as people worry because it's happened so late, is it repeatable? And yes, hey, it's behind a good defensive team. That's part of this. But I see changes and evolution in his game that would lead me to not be stressed at, like, oh, this is just a year or two-year blip. He's going to regress to the guy that he was before he got here. Like, he's adapted. He's made changes. I'm not sure Steve Breer gets enough credit in Toronto for some of the work he's done. When you take a look at the film in L.A. and the film in Toronto, again, it's not huge. It's subtle, but I think it makes a difference. So there's that part. So, you know, is this repeatable? Yeah, if you repeat the defensive environment and don't make drastic changes around him, I think this success can continue. Now the caveat. And I hope the goalie union isn't listening, because they're going to come, like, if there's a ring at the doorbell and you guys hear that, that's them coming to take away my union card. I have said it forever, and I'll say it again. With the position changing so much, the game has changed around goaltenders. And I think Matt Murray was a prime example of this. How he everyone's like, oh, what happened to Matt Murray? How he succeeded in Pittsburgh no longer worked as the game changed around him. The things the Penguins prevented and at one end defensively and accomplished at the other end offensively, including, you know, in terms of creating lateral chances, were things that other teams mimicked and copied, and as that increased in the game, Matt played a low, locked-in style that no longer worked. Like, the guy won two cups. He didn't forget how to play goal, but he needed to change his stance, his setup, and how he plays. And interestingly enough, he's in the process of doing that, despite the Senators sort of getting in the way of themselves a couple times here in the last year. If he could stay healthy, I still think he gets back to it. It's a very long-winded way of saying, I avoid term. Like, that would be my motto as a general manager when it comes to goaltending. And again, they're going to take away the union card, but in very few cases, like, that would be my philosophy. Avoid term wherever you can, unless you really are convinced that you have one of those special athletes at an early age, an Andre Vasilevsky, a Thatcher Demko here in Vancouver. Like, that $5 million over five is starting to look real early like a sweetheart deal. I would, for the most part, avoid term, because even if the goalie doesn't deteriorate, simply the environment around him, the way the game is played even, can negatively affect their ability to have a positive impact on your team.
Well, I hope Jack Campbell's agent was listening to this interview, but just the first half, maybe not the second half. But yeah, I think if you're a Leaf fan, maybe you are still encouraged. But yeah, maybe a 2 or 3 year deal, maybe not a 4 or 5. Kevin, you very much lived up to the intro I gave you. Thanks so much for doing this, man.
I appreciate you having me on. Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin. Kevin Woodley, NHL.com and In Goal Magazine. The PGA Tour returns to continental North America. The California Swing starts tomorrow in La Quinta, California. Tiger Woods won't be there, but will he be at a golf course near you at some point this season? Let's talk to Adam Stanley about it, a golf contributor for Sportsnet.ca, all-around good guy. How's it going, Adam?
Going pretty good. How are you, man?
Good. You know what? I should always intro you as a guy that birdied 12 at Augusta, right? Like, that's the way you want to be introed, right?
From now until forever. I did it. You might as well just say it. It's factually accurate.
Yeah, I did. So congratulations on that. I know it's perhaps an odd way to start for a guy who is not going to play this weekend, but it's the thing people care about most, especially after seeing him at the PNC with Charlie. Tiger, what are your, I don't know if expectations are the right way to phrase it, but if I set the over-under on, I don't know, 1.5 majors played for Tiger this season. Do you take the over?
I take the over. I think he's going to play. I'm confident that he's going to play Augusta National this year. I just think, like, why would he accelerate any kind of return to tee it up with his kid in December, which I don't think anybody thought that he was going to play golf in an event at all in the calendar year of 2021, but he did. And yes, playing with his kid is an alternative in terms of motivation, but I do think that he showed signs of getting back to some semblance of whatever this new normal may be. And Augusta National has always been the safe haven for him. Think about when he came back in 2010 after everything that happened in 2009, you know, came back, played that golf tournament, finished fourth. So I do think he's going to play Augusta, and I do think that he's going to play St. Andrews as well. I don't think that he's going to be quite ready for the U.S. Open and the PGA, if only because he's going to hack it out of some rough at both those golf courses, and his body may not be able to stand up to that. But I do think he's going to play those two. If you set the over-under at 1.5, I'm going to go over, and I'm going to say 2.
Oh, that's good. I like that. Yeah, so you're actually taking something away from, like, not the fact that he just played with Charlie, that he actually, at points, didn't look half bad. I mean, he was able to take a cart, so he won't be able to do that. But that was less than a year removed from almost having his leg removed.
I think that that's one of the things that is going to go down in history as, like, a crazy press conference statement that maybe got, like, brushed over a little bit. But anytime somebody like yourself brings it up, you think, whoa, dude. He literally said that amputation was on the table. Like, this guy, one of the greatest athletes of the 20th century, 21st century, beginning of it as well, said, yeah, dude, I may have lost my leg. And it's like, well, wait a second, what? So, yeah, I mean, that was something that could have happened last year, and he came back. And, you know, you think about the speed that he had at the end of the year in terms of shots that he was hitting off the tee. It was pretty comparable to what he was doing prior to the accident. So you're 100% correct. Taking a cart, playing this hit and giggle with his kid was way different than what a professional golf tournament may be. But he still had to hit the shots. And the shots that he did hit were pretty impressive.
The Canadians are definitely going to play in some majors this year, and we have a couple of them in the top 50 in the world golf rankings. Adam, Corey Connors is 38, Mackenzie Hughes is 42, so they're right in around each other, and both guys have been in and around the top of the leaderboard of some recent majors. Who do you think has the best chance to break through at a major this season?
I think it's got to be Corey, if only because Corey just is a little bit more steady more often than Mackenzie Hughes. Mackenzie Hughes was in the final group on Sunday at the U.S. Open, I believe, last year, and he was in the mix. He was in the conversation, but his career has been a little bit more up and down versus Corey's. I mean, you look at just pure numbers, Corey's like one of the best ball strikers on the planet, and I actually don't think we as a Canadian sporting collective give him enough credit for actually how impressive he is week in and week out on the PGA Tour. Like, he played 25, 26 tournaments last year, and he was in the top 25 in like 20 of them. Like, this is a guy who is so good at so many different facets of the game of professional golf. And the thing that he is pretty poor at, and that was putting, he improved by like 100 spots last year. He was 198th a couple seasons ago. Last year, he was 80th. So now you see a guy who all he needs to do is be average at putting, and he's already 38th in the world. So imagine if he becomes a half-decent putter and what he could actually do in terms of winning and lifting trophies and competing at majors. And this is a guy who's finished in the top 10 at the Masters, the last two Masters. So Mackenzie Hughes, of course, a winner on the PGA Tour already, very solid himself, but Corey's just that much more solid, and I think just has a little bit more going for him right now.
Yeah, I'm with you at Augusta. When I think about putting in my Masters bets, yeah, Corey Connors is definitely going to be a top 25 guy that I put a couple ducats on come April. Yeah. All right. Jordan Spieth, Rory McIlroy, looking to break long major droughts themselves. I mean, Spieth, it's not since the 2017 Open. Of course, his career kind of crumbled, but he's rebuilt it. He's back into the top 25, I think, in the world golf rankings.
Yeah.
Rory McIlroy, 2014 PGA, that's the last major for him. He has four majors and doesn't have one in over 7 years. Which one of those two wins the next one?
Hard to believe about Rory, to be honest. And I don't know what's kind of gotten into him. I think a lot of things have gotten into him. Of course, off the golf course, he got married, became a dad for the first time. But so did Jordan Spieth. I mean, Jordan Spieth just had a kid last fall as well. You know, if I had to pick between the two of them, I would say Rory. Just again, if you're talking about major championships, you're talking about a guy that needs to have you know, kind of everything clicking from the first hole on Thursday to the 72nd hole on Sunday. And I think Jordan Spieth, while he is of course able to have good weeks, his amazing weeks are more few and far between, and he is capable of going off on crazy, crazy tangents and then having to come all the way back around and kind of rescue himself from himself. So I do think that Rory probably is better suited to win a major if you're looking at the body of work from the last little while, and certainly as you look at these golf courses that are going to host this year's majors. I mean, Rory, when Rory's on, you know, A-plus game, and we saw it 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I guess now, at the Canadian Open in 2019, you know, no one was going to touch him that week, and he just plays so, so good when he's on at 100%. And I think that, you know, that's what you need to be when you're competing and trying to win a major, and I think he's a little bit more steady in that regard than Jordan Spieth is.
Can we get a Canadian Open this year? That'd be fun, Adam. I miss it.
It would be fun. I know. I mean, signs are pointing, like, the precedent has been set. You know, athletes are coming across the border and they're trying to figure it out. I don't think if you're unvaccinated, you're not going to be able to play in the Canadian Open, I don't believe. But I don't know. Let's just have it back. I think it's this last year, fine, it kind of made a lot more sense. I think now the precedents. I mean, we had a PGA Tour Champions, a senior event, happened in Calgary last year in September. So, you know, if that's already there as an event that occurred, for pro golfers to come to Canada to play, I don't see why we shouldn't be able to have it back again this summer.
Agreed. Adam, great stuff. Great to catch up. Thanks, man.
Thanks, man. No worries. Looking forward to doing it again.
Sounds good. Adam Stanley, golf contributor for Sportsnet.ca. All right. That'll do it for us today. Steven will be back tomorrow. We will talk to Christine Sinclair tomorrow as well. All right, we'll see you then. This has been The Fan Drive Time. I'm Ben Ennis, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.